Welcome back, sports fans. On this episode of The Checkdown, we cover some major stories, but none bigger than The Bachelor. That's right. Got to find out if Stanford strength and conditioning coach Ross Jergel got his girl back. Oh, entertaining stuff, I'm telling you. But we also cover the Pac-12 conference tournaments, Phil Mickelson's first PGA Tour win in over 4 years, and of course, things get a little weird during the Blitz package, but we do get serious as we discuss DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love's recent struggles with mental health and how the elite sporting world tends to mistakenly hyper-focus on only one element of the athlete's life, winning. But first, here's your jam of the week. This is Jungle by the X-Ambassadors. Kyle, that song really gets the heart pumping, but you know what else gets the heart pumping? Love. And that's where this podcast is going to start, is about love, because we have to close the circle on The Bachelor. Our boy Ross Jergel, strength and conditioning coach from Stanford, if you didn't listen in last week, basically his ex-girlfriend is on The Bachelor. He flew to Peru, tried to win her back. Don't want to go on too long. I'll give you the Spark Notes version. Didn't get her back. She ended up getting asked. He proposed. The Bachelor proposed to Becca. They were going strong for about 2 months. And then he backed out. And he canceled off the engagement. And he asked the other girl that got second place to marry him. This is a crazy story. I don't usually watch The Bachelor, but I watched it for the Stanford guy just to kind of see. And then I got hooked because I was like, there's no way this is actual real life. Did you see it?
I did not watch it, but I heard about it from multiple people. And I have some thoughts, right? So I just feel like it gets more dramatic every single season.
Yeah.
And I don't watch any seasons, but I hear about all of them. And I couldn't help but think, is this just too much drama to be true? Like, is this just, I mean, how perfect for TV is this situation? Like, the guy going down there, it's the love of his life. You know, don't fall in love with this guy, fall back in love with me. And then all of a sudden he proposes to that person.
Yeah.
And then everybody's like, okay, that makes sense. And then he backs out.
Yeah.
And goes to date the other girl. I mean,
well, I feel like
I'm not saying it's fake.
Right.
I'm just saying, if you're a producer or director, you're like, this couldn't have worked out any better.
Yeah, I agree. I think the premise of the show, though, it like doesn't lend for long-term relationships when you think about it. Like, they only hang out for like 2 months total, and actually over the 2 months it's only like six times, and most of those times there's like other people on the dates with them, you know what I mean? So like, yeah, I can also see how this guy after then 2 months after that of actually dating someone one-on-one, basically like he just dated her and was like, oh hey, this isn't gonna work out, but he already had to propose to her because that's how the show is supposed to end. So like, it's like any other normal relationship that doesn't go well after 2 months, but like for him, it's he was already engaged to her, just reversed. Well,
it's amazing to me at this point in this show, and people have watched so many seasons, that they still commit to it. Because if you look at the track record of the people that win and get proposed to, or they propose, like very, very small percentage of them actually end up getting married and have relationships, whatever. There's been a few.
Right.
Fine. But then, lost my train of thought. But I just don't understand how people can stay committed to this when it's just been unsuccessful for so long.
Yeah.
I don't get it. And one thing that I would think if I was a bachelor or the bachelorette, either way, I would just be bummed that I had to commit to one person after 3 months of dating like 25 women. Like, I know that sounds terrible, but think about it. You go through 2.5 months, you're like, make out this girl, yeah, make out that girl, go on this date, go on that date, and all of a sudden they're like, yeah, pick one. You're like, why? But 25 is so much more fun than one. So I totally understand how you could pick one, and then 2 months later be like, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that.
Your opinion of a happy relationship is going to change so dramatically because you've been dating 20 women for 2 months. So.
Right.
It's definitely, it's just a really unhealthy process.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And, you know, this is a Pac-12 focused podcast, and so our heart and we will always side with Ross Jurgel. Our thoughts are with him. I hope he's doing all right. I hope he got a great workout in back at the Stanford facility. Just kind of worked out all that anger and sadness. But, you know, just an interesting show. Maybe he'll be the next Bachelor. That's kind of interesting, right? Maybe he was all publicity stunt for him, too. Who knows? I mean, I don't really know what he looks like other than what I saw on TV, but he was in a good suit. You know, he had a good haircut. I feel like he could pull it off. I don't know. Maybe.
Could we get him on the show?
I mean, we may know some people at Stanford that can connect us. Yeah, we could try.
I mean, how famous is this guy? Right, he's on TV for a couple episodes.
Yeah.
Like, how many people knows his name? How many people know his name? Like, maybe a well-crafted email is all we need to get to 15 minutes.
Yeah, maybe. And, you know, I will tell you, I think we had about 70 listeners to the last podcast, so at least 70 people know his name and who he is because they heard us talking about it last week. So, anywho, but let's move on to some Pac-12 stuff. Let's basketball update. So, men's basketball, Arizona won the regular season title. The conference tournament just started as of yesterday. In the opening round of the tournament, Colorado beat ASU 97-85. ASU really fell off the map. I mean, they were ranked like in the top five at one point, and they totally just took a turn for the worse. And Stanford beat Cal 76-58. Oregon State outlasted Washington in overtime to win 69-66, and Oregon came from behind to beat Washington State 64-62 in OT. They were down by as much as 11, so the matchups, there are games going on right now as we speak, actually. Colorado versus Arizona, Stanford versus UCLA, Oregon State versus USC, and Oregon versus Utah. A lot of good matchups. I know I talked about this with Sky the other day. I like the way UCLA is playing, and I know that probably hurts your heart as much as it hurts mine, too. But
it does.
Aaron Holiday is a stud. He might be the best point guard in – he might be better than – what's his name? Trey Mason or whatever his name is from Oklahoma.
Trey Young.
Honestly, have you seen Aaron Holiday play? He scored 34 points.
Trae Young averages 28 points a game.
Yeah, but he also shoots 35 times, so it's not a very good percentage.
Shots don't matter.
Anywho, I'm just saying.
Ask Kobe.
Watch Aaron Holiday, his name, climb up for the draft if he enters. But yeah, as far as – and then getting back to the – Arizona scandal a little bit because Sean Miller is back coaching and DeAndre Ayton is obviously playing still. Sean Miller came out and basically vehemently denied that he had anything to do with the agency or even talked to anybody or anything that was alleged against him. He came out and denied. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, somebody is either lying, right? He's either lying that it didn't happen or the report is totally off and lied that he was involved. So what are your thoughts on that?
If you look at the track record of these type of things, the majority of the time, the denial is just hoping that they can't prove it.
Right.
And 95% of the time, these guys deny, and it ends up coming out that it's actually true. I mean, think about like Lance Armstrong.
Yeah.
He's like trying to file a lawsuit, and then it comes out that everything that they were accusing him of was accurate. And if you look historically, how many times do these things come out and they get blown up like they have and it turns out to be false? Very, very, very few.
Yeah, it's a good point.
I mean, even in today's world of fake news, reporters are still going to check their sources 10 times before publishing anything. And so the majority of the time when these things come out, they are accurate. So, I mean, if you put yourself in his position, your safest bet is to just deny like it never happened and just hope they can't prove it. What's your alternative? Admit to it, get fired, get fined, get suspended, maybe never get a job again. I don't know. But admitting to it is not a great option when you have the option to just deny and just hope that it kind of fizzles out. So I don't know.
That's a good point. I mean, and that's what's crazy is 1 week ago, literally, Sean Miller was like going to get fired from Arizona. He was out. He was going to be disgraced. And then all of a sudden he came out and denied it. And now it's like, well, where do we go from here? We're kind of at a standstill. So it is definitely going to be interesting to see how that all plays out. But one thing is for sure, he will be coaching and DeAndre Ayton will be playing in March Madness. They're going to go no matter what, even if they don't win the conference tournament. So they're the team that allegedly has the best chance to make a deep run in March Madness. Who knows?
So does the authenticity of the denial and the optics of his denial matter in the next steps that the NCAA takes in the accusations against him, right? Like, if he comes out and it looks like he's reading off a piece of paper and he says, I didn't do it, I follow the rules, I love my team, I love my family, blah, 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 they're like, okay, whatever, dude. Like,
yeah.
You're the next guy that's going to get the axe. Or he comes out and he's like, and he just, it's super authentic, it seems like he's telling the truth, and he's just, you know, deny, and I'm like, wow, maybe he didn't do it. Does the authenticity of his denial have any effect on how they've treated this last week or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. I think that if you listen to his denial, he actually did like a very specific denial of the things that were alleged against him. He didn't just like get up there and be like, oh, I didn't do this stuff that they said, like, I love Arizona, like the general cliche. He was like, I never talked to Christian Dawkins or whatever the guy's name is. I never worked with an agency to ever try and get DeAndre Ayton 100. Like, he came out and was like specifically denying the things that had been specifically alleged against him, which I feel like makes it seem a little bit more like authentic.
Well, that's why I bring it up, because a lot of people have been saying like, dang, that sounded like he really meant it. Like,
right.
He really didn't do it. So I wonder if that had any effect on the way this last, you know, 6 or 7 days has unfolded.
Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely going to be interesting to see how it all plays out. But obviously, we're going to get an answer at some point, because either the article is going to come out and say, oh, we had our timeline wrong and our phone number's wrong or something, or he's going to get caught, and then we'll see what happens from there. But yeah.
So on the Pac-12 basketball note, what are the odds that SC and UCLA get in the tournament? It does either one of them have to make this conference final to go? Because UCLA can't. Like, they play Arizona next round.
Yeah.
So do they have to beat Arizona and win the Pac-12 to get into the tournament? And then on the USC side, they have a pretty easy route to get to that as the 2 seed to get to the Pac-12 championship. They just beat Oregon State 61-48. So they're going to play the winner of Washington and Oregon and Utah.
Hey, we're doing live updates, aren't we? Because that game just ended.
We are. Yeah, I just did that.
Whoa. Okay. That's right. And UCLA just beat Stanford, too. You're right. So Arizona will face UCLA.
That's right.
Okay. Wow. Live updates. Caught me off guard.
On top of my game tonight.
Yeah.
So does UCLA have to beat Arizona and win the Pac-12 to get into the tournament? Does USC have to beat either Oregon or Utah and win the Pac-12 to get in? Or does USC or UCLA just get to the finals and prove that they are a top three team in the Pac-12 in order to make the tournament? I've always been confused about the selection process, and with so many conferences and you know, 10 or 12 seeds going to weaker conferences, their champion has to go just because the rules, whatever it is. I never know how to judge. And so, like, what do you think? What does USC or UCLA have to do to get in?
Yeah, well, I think UCLA definitely has a better chance, because if they beat Arizona in the next round, they'll have a ranked opponent win, which is a huge plus to get in. So that will definitely help. And then if they win the conference tournament as well, I feel like the conference – or the win against – they'll get in for sure if they win the conference. But the win against Arizona, I feel like if they can beat them, will help either way. USC doesn't have as much – they would have to win it, in my opinion, because they're going to play a lesser Oregon or Utah. And then – you know, whoever they match up against in the finals, UCLA or Arizona, if they can beat them, then yeah, they'll go. But if they can't, I think USC is on the bubble and they won't go. I think if UCLA loses to Arizona, they don't go either, though. I think they're both on the bubble right now, and they're like two of the last four out, if that makes sense.
They get like an 11 seed or something.
Yeah. So.
So does the conference not? I mean, is the Pac-12 that bad? Like, USC was the number 2 seed in the regular season. Number 2, like, they got a whole side of the bracket to themselves.
Yeah.
And if they don't win this conference tournament, like, they're not going to get in. Like, that is rough. There are other tournaments in this – or other conferences in this country where, like, 7 teams get in.
I know. Like, the ACC and the Big East, and I mean, there's I don't know. It's hard. I mean, Arizona is the only ranked team in the Pac-12 right now, and they're ranked, I think, 14th or 17th. So, like,
yeah, but only 25 teams are ranked, and 66 or 68 teams get into the tournament.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, ranking can't be everything, obviously, because then there'll only be 25 teams in the tournament. So,
I don't know. Yeah, I know. The selection process is a lot more complicated, I think, because they start to – because there's so many games and there's so many, like – interconference games that it's kind of look at wins against ranked opponent, losses against ranked and non-ranked opponents. You know, like, I don't know. There's some sort of formula, and I don't know too much about it, but I think to answer your question, I think UCLA has at least a better path if they can beat Arizona. The only way that maybe all three of them could get in is if UCLA beats Arizona, makes it to the finals, and then USC also makes it to the finals and beats UCLA. So USC would be the automatic bid. UCLA would have another win over a ranked opponent, and Arizona, because they're ranked in their and what they've done all year, maybe the three of them could go. But I don't know. I'm not really sure how it all plays out.
Well, I hope one other team besides Arizona gets in, so we have two teams to root for.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. We can't just put all our eggs in one basket. That would be depressing.
I know. And how much does it suck that the one team that you have to put all your eggs in one basket is the team that's in the midst of a scandal?
Legally, whatever. We can't get one legitimate basketball team in the tournament.
I know.
We can't get one. But not one. The one that's going to go is just a bunch of cheaters.
One thing's for sure, they're going to have to forfeit all the games no matter how far that they get into the tournament.
Yeah,
Oh, but anyways, let's move on to women's. So Oregon women's won the regular season title, and then on Sunday, so their conference tournament was actually last weekend, they won 77-57 by 20 points over Stanford in the Pac-12 tournament title game for the program's first ever Pac-12 tournament title. And our girl, Sabrina Ionescu, exploded for a career high and a Pac-12 conference championship record, 36 points.
Wow.
What does this girl not do? I feel like every time we come on the podcast, she's done something new that, like, we bring up because she's just crushing it. But
that's amazing.
Yeah, so they're just kind of waiting for the seeding, and their March Madness will start in the next week or so as well. So we'll see. We'll have more updates for them when the bracket comes out for the women and the men's side. But moving on as well, big news and something that made me so happy. Phil Mickelson. He won. He won his tournament, former ASU Sun Devil. He had played 101 tournaments around the world since his last win at Muirfield in 2013 in the Open. He went four full years without a win, and he definitely won this tournament in epic fashion. I don't know if you watched it, but he shot under 70 all four rounds, 69, 68, 65, and 66. He finished his tournament 16 under. He and Justin Thomas went into a playoff hole, and Phil parred it, and Thomas bogeyed it, so he walked away with $1.7 million for the win, a long time coming. I think he's 47 years old and Justin Thomas is 24. What are your thoughts about that? I thought that was awesome.
I did watch it. I thought it was an amazing end to a tournament. It was a WGC, so top 50 in the world, super strong field, really unique golf course.
Mm-hmm.
Right in Mexico, they really don't play any international tournaments for the most part outside of, you know, the British Open.
Right.
And maybe a couple guys play a couple in Dubai or whatever it is, but you know they don't play a lot outside of the U.S. So different fan base in Mexico. Justin Thomas in the playoff hole almost got his ball stepped on by a cameraman. I don't know if you saw that.
I saw that. That was crazy.
He's sitting there lining up his chip, and a cameraman literally walks up and is 5 inches away from just stepping on his ball and smashing it into the grass. And Justin Thomas, like, straight up Heisman, just like boom, like stiff arm, palm to the chest, like, what are you doing? And the guy's like, oh, my bad. Like, he didn't know, like, the guy that everybody's watching is standing right there.
Yeah. Before you go any further, fill the audience in, and because I'm not extremely clear either, what would have happened if he did step on it? Is it a penalty for Justin Thomas? Is it, like, does he get a free drop? What's the rule?
So he gets a free drop.
Okay.
And they were interviewing him afterwards, and the announcers brought it up, and Justin Thomas brought it up, like, I should have let him step on it, because if he would have, and would have got a free drop, and it would have been a better lie than I had in the first place.
Right.
So, would have actually benefited him. But anyway, in regulation, Justin Thomas holed out on 18 from like 110 from the fairway.
Yeah.
Eagle to get to 16 under. And then Phil ended up going to 16 under, then went to the playoff. The playoff was a little disappointing because Justin Thomas just had too much juice going. So just so you know, it was 155 to the center of that green. Justin Thomas hit a gap wedge. He hit a gap wedge and he flew the green. How in the world does anybody that is 5'10", a buck 75, soaking wet, hit a gap wedge 170 yards in the air?
I don't know. That's insane.
That is absolutely bonkers.
Yeah. He just hit it flush. He just, right in the sweet spot, you know?
I'm super happy for Phil. Yeah. He hadn't won in a long time. It was great to see him in the winner's circle. I feel like I've been watching him year after year, and he's just top 10 city. He always plays well. He rarely misses cuts. He's in there, you know, between the 6th and 10th place very, very often, but never kind of closes it out. So good to see him, you know, get that win. And 47 years of age, that's just so impressive. I mean, people say that Tiger's not going to make the comeback because he's 40.
Right.
And then you look out there and Phil plays 36, 37 tournaments a year at age 47 and just contends.
Yeah.
Just so impressive.
And Phil, even after, was saying that, you know, he feels like he's playing his best golf right now. And if Tiger continues on that trajectory, do you think that we could have a Tiger lefty final round Sunday at the Masters? Is that, come on. That's like what everyone wants, right?
Now, if the internet would explode.
Again.
Caucasian individuals over 40 years old everywhere.
Yeah.
Caucasian males over the age of 40 that make $100,000 a year or more would all be tuned in to watch.
I really hope that happens. But so with his WGC Mexico Championship victory, Phil moved into fourth place in the U.S. Ryder Cup team standings behind Justin Thomas, Dustin Johnson, and Brooks Koepka, and enhanced his chances of making the team on points for the 12th straight time dating back to 1995. So this would be his 12th straight Ryder Cup. However,
that's amazing.
Yeah, he has yet to win the Ryder Cup when it's held in Europe, which it is held in Europe this round, I believe.
Really?
Or, no, we skip a year. Right?
Yes, Ryder Presidents.
So this year's a president, so next year is actually in the United States. So, yeah, but he hasn't won when it's been in Europe.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I don't know what it is.
The European team plays really, really well overseas. Mm-hmm. And it's a different type of golf. And regardless of where they play, the European team puts up a fight.
Yeah.
President's Cup is, I don't know, a little lame.
Mm-hmm.
Like the international team, although they have two or three really big superstars, outside of the European guys, they can't really put up that much of a fight. But the Ryder Cup is so intense. I mean, Ryder Cup is one of the bucket list things for me.
Yeah, oh, that'd be so
because
great.
Because you get to wear your American flag, Stars and Stripes pants. Right, everybody's all cheering for the same team, for the same guys. Like, I don't know, the camaraderie and everything. I would almost rather go to a Ryder Cup than Augusta.
Right.
I don't know. When I said it, I felt like maybe I changed my mind. But one of those two things would just be incredible.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough decision. But I think if I had to choose, I would do the Masters. But the Ryder Cup would be so great because it's such a different atmosphere too. You know, it's not like it's not like a traditional golf atmosphere either, so I don't know. I mean, they'd both be pretty fun, so luckily we don't have to choose that because we're not going to either. So
yep, that's right. Problem solved.
Yeah. Also, I wanted to bring the story back up. So remember I told the story about when I yelled at Phil walking off the tee that my grandma loved him and I thought he gave me the thumbs up, and then I realized he was giving it to everybody when he was walking. I was watching him on TV. Literally, I counted almost every fifth step he threw up the thumbs up. Like, it's just like so mechanical for him. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you throw it up, and then the other way, and then the other. I was like, oh my gosh, that's so funny. But
I don't even think he knows he's doing it. Like, at this point, it's one of those things where, like, it's like the hat nod for
right.
golfers, too. Like, especially Phil. Oh my gosh. This guy's been a professional golfer for, like, 30 years, 25 years been on PGA Tour.
Yeah.
And it's like breathing. He goes, step, step, thumbs up, step, step, hat, step, step, thumbs up, step, 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 hat. And it's like, I bet he walks around his house and he goes from his bedroom to his bathroom and like halfway there, he like thumbs up the wall.
Yeah.
And then he gets out of the shower and he like nods his hat to his wife. He's like, oh, sorry, I just have it. Like, they do it so much. There's no way they think about it. That has to be autopilot.
It has. That's true. His wife has no idea why she's getting the thumbs up or the head tap.
Please stop giving I don't need the thumbs up. I'm his wife.
Oh my gosh, that's funny. But anyways, it'll be fun to see. We're getting closer and closer to the Masters, so hopefully we get a deep push by Lefty or Tiger or both. That would be obviously best case scenario. But shifting gears a little bit, get into the mental health talk that's been going around major sports right now. So
DeMar, that was a rocky segue.
I know. I didn't know how else to do that because this is a little bit tougher of a subject. But so
you're shifting from first to fifth gear. Right there.
Yeah, really had to slow it down. But DeMar DeRozan talked a few weeks ago about his bouts with depression and how at times they can become overwhelming. Kevin Love came out a few days later to discuss his struggle with anxiety. Love was taken to the hospital during a November 5th loss to the Hawks with what he described at the time as stomach pain and shortness of breath. But in his Players Tribune essay, put the emphasis on the wrong syllable there. He acknowledged the symptoms were caused by a panic attack. So, you know, I think this is a great discussion to have, and I think it's really important for premier athletes like these two guys to come out and talk about mental health and mental health awareness. I work in the mental health field, and athletes are not immune to these things. And I think that sometimes we as fans only hold them to a certain standard because we think they have money and they have athletic ability and they have physique and all these things that we would want. But that doesn't mean that they're immune to mental health and mental health issues. And I think mental health in general is one of the world's greatest silent epidemics that we don't really talk about, especially with athletes. So I don't know. I'm just really happy to see guys of this caliber come out and talk about it and trying to bring awareness about it and bring these things up. So what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think that a lot of people, like you said, think that, you know, anxiety and depression are linked a lot of time,
mm-hmm.
In people's opinions. And when you think of depression, people that don't understand it think that they're just sad,
right,
or something like that, and they think, "Well, how could you be sad? You have millions of dollars. How could you be sad? Or how could you be depressed? You're in the NBA." But it's, you know, it's different than that. And like me, for me personally, like I take anxiety medication every day,
mm-hmm.
and I think that most people know me, and hopefully the listeners, right, would think that I am like I'm a very glass half full guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a mellow dude, and I'm always, you know, I tend to just be happy most of the time. And just because you struggle with anxiety or depression or any, you know, mental illness doesn't mean that you're the kind of guy that just, you know, wears all black and is bummed out and doesn't have friends. Like it doesn't have to manifest itself in that personality trait.
Right.
Regular people, you know, high-strung people, mellow people, athletic people, you know, corporate executives, whatever it is, you know, all economic scales, you know, everything, and anybody can be affected by it. And so it is interesting and nice to see those guys, you know, coming out, because it's nobody's, you know, immune to it. It can affect anybody.
Yeah, it's definitely the great equalizer. And I think the thing for me that's unique as far as how it relates to athletes specifically, like, you know, there's obviously a lot of influences that cause or that can influence mental health disorders. And I think, you know, you can have biological, family, cognitive and behavioral stuff. But I think one of the big ones is like the psychological stress of major life events. And so like these guys' jobs is literally to put themselves in a position for people to judge them on their perceived abilities and what they think that their other people are owed. And like that's a lot of stress on top of things that a lot of us go through already, like death in the family or a major illness to a family member or other things like that, that a lot of these, even financial instability or relocation purposes, like all of these things that people have to deal with in general. And then you add on top that their job is literally to be put in the spotlight for people to judge them on how they're performing. Like that is a very stressful life circumstance to be in every single day of your life. And when you're not playing up to what you think or what other people think you should be playing up to, like the amount of stress and pressure you put on yourself can be, you know, debilitating. And I think sometimes we take that for granted. Like we just come on this podcast and talk about guys like, oh, this is fun. But like at the end of the day, there's a tremendous amount of pressure, both self-imposed and by, you know, outside influences that they take into account. And I think are it's really something that we should take into consideration more often, because I think that like the elite sporting world really only hyper focuses on one element of premier athletes, and that's winning, right? Like, and if they're winning, then we think that they're doing exactly what they should be doing, and everything is going right in their life, and that's how it should be. But like, we're not in their lives, you know, like we just get to see them do their job basically. So, you know, and then on top of that, obviously the stigma of mental health issues is in the sporting world and in general, I think leads to a culture of masking and because it's seen as a weakness. And I don't see it like that. You know, I see it more as, I think being able to be vulnerable about it, even like you just were, is something that is, in my opinion, a strength. And when you are able to do that and able to bring awareness to it, I think you build a community of people, and community itself is one of the main ways to help these mental health, whether it's anxiety or depression. That's one of the main things is social support. It's always reaching out when you're in need or when you need something. So I'm just really pleased with them coming out and talking about that and bringing awareness to it, because I find it very important, and it's something that I deal with and I see a lot of. And so I'm happy about that. But just for some numbers too, just because I think it's important to know kind of the severity of it. The NCAA actually did a study back in 2007. I wanted to look it up just to read, but they found that between 10 and 15% of student athletes will experience psychological issues severe enough to warrant counseling or even a diagnosis. Like, that's a lot. That's a lot of kids and a lot of people that are affected by something. And like I said, stressors of just normal life and trying to be a student, and then on top of that, trying to perform at your peak performance and be judged on it and by yourself and by other people around you. I think that's just a lot. So, you know,
I just, one thing on that is I think people forget about the fact that I think that being in the spotlight a lot of times isn't for everybody. And I know there's a lot of people out there that they get famous and whatever, you know, whether it's acting or music or athletics or whatever it is, and they relish it, and they love that attention. They love being in the spotlight. They don't mind the criticism. It's all fuel to them, and that's great. But then I think that there's probably an equal amount of people that are really, really good at what they do, but the spotlight isn't something that they crave. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just a byproduct of the talent level that they have. Half of the guys in the NBA probably don't want to do press conferences.
Right.
They probably don't want to be in commercials. You know, they're happy to make millions of dollars playing what they love to do, but they probably don't want to go on ESPN or Twitter every night and see people bashing them.
Right.
You know, maybe they still have self-esteem issues. Just because you're really good at your sport doesn't mean you don't have, you know, confidence issues or self-esteem issues or whatever it is. And so I think for a lot of people, being in the spotlight and constantly seeing that criticism all the time can be a struggle. For more people than I think normal people would think. I think for a lot of people, it's probably difficult. And if you were to put yourself in their shoes, it's probably not as easy as it looks on TV.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. And when I was talking about this, I thought, or when I was kind of researching and just reading up on it and listening to what other people were saying, I thought, I couldn't help but think about kind of our discussion last week about the one and done situation and how, like how to make it better for those young guys, right? Like, I know we had talked previously about like making sure they have financial coaches and all that sort of stuff to make sure they manage their money well and they're not getting screwed over or you know, investing in things that are unsafe or whatever. But like, I feel like this is a huge part of it too, right? Like, this is something that I would really like to see, not just for the young guys coming out, the one and dones, or the, even if we get rid of that or whatever happens with that, but for even the veteran guys that have figured it out, like, you never know when these things are going to happen. And that's even something that Kevin Love wrote in his letter, was like, you know, he had never had one before. And then he just had one literally a month ago. And that's the first time ever. And so it's like, I think it's really important for the NBA and NFL and all major athletics to take that next step of realizing that mental health is equally as important as these guys' physical health. You know, they take care of their bodies immensely. And so I think it's equally as important to make sure that as institutions and as businesses, that they take care of their employees, and in this case, the athletes, and make sure that their mental health is as equally as well taken care of. So I don't know. I just thought that, especially for young kids coming right out of high school, if that's what they go to, or even kids that are 1 year out of high school, you know, making sure that they know the resources that are available to them and connect them in ways that can get them help if they need it, I think would be really beneficial.
Agree to agree.
Yes, agree to agree. But that was our... that was our more serious discussion. Let's get back to a little bit of fun. Well, actually, the story doesn't sound fun at first, but it is fun. I don't know if you heard about Christian McCaffrey, but You can add saving lives to his list of talents because he was hiking with family and friends in Castle Rock, Colorado, and he witnessed Dan Smoker Sr., a 72-year-old, fall about 20 feet onto a rock while hiking with his grandson. McCaffrey and his friends immediately ran over, called 911, made sure he was stabilized, and they got him help, and they got him to the hospital, and he suffered, this poor guy, suffered a broken femur, broken pelvis, broken neck, fractured ribs, and had bleeding on the brain. He's in critical yet stable condition, and they think he's going to make a full recovery. So that's just an amazing story. You know, to me, like, just the luck of the draw, but also the willingness for him to act. Like, what a great guy. Christian McCaffrey just seems like a stand-up guy.
He does seem like a great dude. I always thought that. He seems like a guy that takes care of his responsibilities off the field. He's never been in trouble that I'm aware of, and obviously, you know, going to Stanford, you kind of have to have you kind of have to be, you know, the best of the best, not right. just on the field, but in the classroom, and you have to, you know, be multi-talented. So this didn't surprise me to see that he would do something like this. So hats off to him, because he seems like a great guy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Pac-12, just scoring touchdowns and saving lives. That's what he does. It's interesting to think that him and Ross Jurgel are both from Stanford. You know, on one end we have a guy flying to Peru to find love. I just think it shows the depth of the Pac-12 conference. Am I right? Like, we have guys that are romantics, and we have guys that spring into action when somebody gets hurt, and we have guys that score touchdowns. I don't know. It's great. Oh, and that's what I didn't mention. I forgot to say this, but DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love are both former Pac-12 players. DeMar DeRozan from USC and Kevin Love from UCLA. So Pac-12 ties as well for them.
That's right.
So I thought that was kind of cool. Yeah, but anyways, thought that was a fun story. Let's move on, have a little bit more fun with our Blitz package. I've got a couple good ones for you today. I've been holding on to one since the Combine and since all the talk about some of the players there. So I can go first if you want.
Yeah, you go first.
Okay. So you love Baker Mayfield, am I correct?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So the two guys after the Combine that he has been most compared to and who they say he is most like are, number one, Johnny Manziel, and number two, Case Keenum. Yes, I can't tell you how happy that makes me, because you hate Case Keenum. You said he's not any good, and they're comparing him to him as far as production-wise and his abilities at the college level, and then also what he's going to be able to do at the pro level. So I just want to know, if you had to pick one of the two, who would you say he is more like, or you hope he is like? Well, that's not a good question, because Johnny Manziel kind of petered out, but who would you say he's more like?
I feel like he has a lot more athletic ability than Case Keenum. The guy can run, he can scramble, he's an athlete, he's a winner, he's a fighter. Not to say that Case Keenum's not. I think that they were trying to compare him to be a mixture of those two guys, Johnny Manziel being the scramble guy, he can run for first downs, and then Case Keenum, you know, being a little bit undersized but very accurate in the pocket, those kind of things. Maybe you put those two guys together, you get a little bit of Baker Mayfield. But I think that, and I've said this before, but with other guys, but I think that Baker Mayfield is going to be better than his statistics show. I think that he's a winner. I think that he's a fighter. I think he is a little bit undersized, but that we've proven over the last 10 years that there's been some guys that come out that are a little bit undersized that can still perform in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I guess we'll have to see how that goes. I would say Case Keenum just because he's been successful. I mean, he's danced around before this recent stint, but he's had some success in the league. And if you play 10 years in the NFL, you still end up playing 10 years. Even if you play for three or four teams, and even if half of the time you're a backup, that's still a successful career. And I think anybody would take that, even coming out of college as highly touted as Baker Mayfield was. One of the reasons why I'm not against the comparison to Case Keenum's, because Case Keenum's college career was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The guy put up ridiculous statistics, so did Baker Mayfield. I get the comparison there. They're both, you know, Heisman level players in college. Mm-hmm. So whether that translates to Baker Mayfield's career in the NFL to be like Case Keenum, or maybe it's just a strictly college comparison, I don't know, but you do love Case Keenum.
I do, and I really just loved this question because I know how much you don't like Johnny Manziel and Case Keenum, and the fact that he's compared to both of them just made me so happy, because I knew I was going to be able to kind of put you in a corner.
What about Russell Wilson? There's no Russell Wilson comparison?
Well, there is as far as size-wise, but I think experts think that Russell Wilson is more athletic than Baker Mayfield, which is hard to argue against. Russell Wilson is a pretty phenomenal athlete as far as running and agility and that sort of stuff. I don't know how...
He is.
And Baker Mayfield, I think he put up a good time, like a 4.8 in the 40 or something. So not blazing fast, but I mean, that's still pretty freaking fast for quarterbacks. So
I guess my thoughts are Baker Mayfield has a huge arm, a bigger arm than people thought he had.
Mm-hmm.
Russell Wilson has a big arm. And I think Baker Mayfield, and they were saying it when he was running his 40, like he's shifty.
Right.
He's hard to tackle. He moves laterally very well. Just because he runs a 4.8 doesn't mean he's not elusive
right.
in the pocket. So,
yeah. Same as Sam Darnold. And we'll, actually, it's a good segue. We'll get into the combine stuff a little bit next week, too. We have our combine expert, Andrew Ross, coming on the show. He's got all the ins and outs for us. But, yeah, I agree. And they were saying that the same thing about Sam Darnold, about he ran like a 4.83 or 4.84 or something. And but for him, it's not necessarily about that. He's deceptive and he's shifty, like you said, in the pocket. And I feel like for him, that's it's a better skill set to have than the blazing speed, kind of like Lamar Jackson. He didn't run the 40, but they think he's going to run like a 4.4 or something ridiculous like that. So,
well, and Sam Darnold's such a big kid too.
Yeah.
You know, like those. If you're Baker Mayfield and you're 6'2", 205, like you probably need to run a pretty quick 40. But I mean, these other quarterbacks, the majority of them are all 6'4", 225. You're 6'4", 225, and you're running 4.8.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big dude to get moving. So.
Absolutely.
Whatever.
All right. Well, that was my first one. What do you got for me?
All right. So I have a combine question, too.
Okay.
A couple of guys that stood out to me, stood out to the entire country. Shaquem Griffin.
Uh-huh.
And Saquon Barkley. Both of which have a Q in their first name. Go figure. just stood out to me.
Okay.
So Shaquem Griffin was all over SportsCenter, all over all the shows, just like absolutely super impressive. Guy's got 1.5 arms, mm-hmm. which is just amazing. And,
yeah.
and I watched him play in that bowl game, that big time, you know, New Year's Six bowl game, and he just performed.
Right.
Just absolutely performed. Unbelievable. The guy can even catch a football, which I don't even understand. He ran a 4.38, and he's a linebacker, mind you. 20 reps on the bench press and a 117-inch broad jump. The guy just outperformed everybody.
Yeah.
He's a little bit undersized at 220 for a linebacker, which is a little small.
Uh-huh.
But just absolutely incredible stats. On the other side, Saquon Barkley had an incredible combine. I've been high on this kid since halfway through the last college football season because I feel like there are only so many running backs, and although running backs are a dime a dozen these days in the NFL, and everybody talks about, oh, it's a dying breed, it's like the center of the NBA, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
220-plus pound running backs that can take it to the outside and run away from corners, but also run you over down the middle and catch the ball to the backfield, those are not a dime a dozen. Those guys are – I mean, Adrian Peterson can't even catch a football.
Yeah.
That guy's a Hall of Famer. You got the Leonard Fournettes. You got Todd Gurley. You got Zeke Elliott. You got Le'Veon Bell. I mean, David Johnson. There's like probably 4 or 5 guys in the NFL that make that big of a difference on the football field. Saquon Barkley in the combine, 4.4 40. He's 230 pounds.
Jeez.
29 reps on the bench. He has a 41-inch vert. A 230-pound guy got up 40 inches. 4.24, 20-yard shuttle. Anyway, he was... For the 40, for the bench press, and for the vertical, he's number one out of all running backs. So my question is, for both of these guys, how high do you take either one of them? And then what are their NFL prospects, just in your opinion?
Okay, well, I'll start with Saquon Barkley because I think he's the hot topic right now. I don't know if you can draft a running back number one overall. I think number one overalls are reserved for quarterbacks, left tackles, and edge rushers, defensive ends. And if you're not a game changer in either one of those three, I think I don't know. I don't think you can take him one overall. Two, yeah, because I think he's the next best. I think he's the best prospect as far as athletic ability and what he produced when he was at Penn State. But I think the way the NFL works, the three most impactful positions on any football field for the large majority of the teams are one of those three positions, left tackle, edge rusher, or quarterback. And so I don't think you can take him number one overall. As far as Shaquem Griffin from Central Florida, I mean, it's hard. I think he showed that he's at least first or second round talent, right? As far as athletic ability and even his production on the field. I mean, he won like back-to-back American Conference or whatever conference they're in, Defensive Players of the Year, something like that. At least he won it last year for sure. So like he's got the production at the college level and then now the athletic ability to go on top of it as far as the measurables go. So, I mean, I don't know. And I think the next thing you have to take into account is like what he was like when he was in college. Like what do his teammates say? What do his coaches say about him? And from what I understand, there's nothing wrong. So I think somebody that has that level of production, that level of athletic talent, athletic ability, paired with that the character level he has, and then also the fact that he has a disability and that he doesn't have a left hand, I believe. It's one of his hands was amputated when he was four years old. But like, those are the guys that I feel like other guys want in their locker room. You know what I mean? And so like, I think you can take a shot with him because he doesn't have any real red flags right now other than one hand, but he's proven that he can get over that and play at the highest level and beat big teams. So I think he's going to creep into the first round and at the worst second round.
Solid. That's good. I think Saquon Barkley, I think, is an absolute animal.
Yeah.
In my opinion, and like I said, I've been saying this since the beginning of the season or the middle of the college football season, if you need a quarterback, you have to take a quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot win in the NFL without a quarterback. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if you have Leonard Fournette, Todd Gurley, and Adrian Peterson as prime. It doesn't matter. Like, you have to have a quarterback to win in the NFL. Although, gosh, this last NFL playoffs.
Yeah, I know.
But if you don't need a quarterback, if you're one of the teams in the top five, and you feel like you have a quarterback, you have to take this kid.
Yeah.
Okay, I get it. Left tackle, defensive end, game changers. This guy's a game changer. I'm telling you right now. Look at how dynamic Todd Gurley is for the Rams. He does everything for that team. And they have a quarterback that they don't even have that much confidence in, but because you can't stop him, you know, on the outside and the inside, catching the ball to the backfield, you know, running routes in the slot, he does everything. And this guy can do that exact same thing. And from everything I read, he has an incredible work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of those guys that just focuses on football and he grinds and football is life.
Yeah.
This kind of guy is going to be a Pro Bowler. I mean, he's going to be Rookie of the Year. I think.
Really?
I'd put money on it. Ooh. I would. I think he's a freak. And I also think running backs can come out of college and make an impact right away, whereas quarterbacks is really difficult to do that. So you're not going to see a Sam Darnold or, you know, one of those guys come out and just blow it up. It's just really difficult.
That's true. Are you confident enough to put a beer soup on it?
I'll put a beer soup on it. Saquon Barkley. Offensive Rookie of the Year.
All right. Fair. So far we have that NBA Finals. East won't win. It'll end in game five or less. Four or five. The West will win it. And Saquon Barkley is Offensive Rookie of the Year. All right. Fair enough. We got to keep track of all these.
One more thing. So with with Shaquem Griffin.
Oh, yeah.
His weight makes me nervous. Being undersized like that makes me nervous. I know he's super fast, but I think he's super fast because he's light. And then I also have another question, and I mean this with so much respect. Please don't. I don't want to get hate mail. How much weight is he losing without having a hand?
Oh, I don't know.
Like, if he had a hand and that part of his forearm, would he be like closer to 230? Does a hand weigh 10 pounds?
I don't know. How much does a hand weigh?
Is his weight not a true indication of his actual full body weight because he's missing an appendage?
Right.
Somebody brought that up to me the other day, and I was like, that's a really good point. I know you're not going to have an answer to that unless you're Googling it really fast.
I'm trying to Google how much does a human hand weigh.
But I would be leery about taking him in the first couple rounds only because he's undersized. I mean, he's going to have trouble catching the football. I hate to say it. But, yeah. I mean, if you're an NFL executive, you got to think about those things. So most of the projections have him going third or fourth round. If somebody you know, gives him a chance and picks him up in the second round, I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
But even though he had an incredible combine, I think he probably slipped slower than people would like to see.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, though, with that speed, if he can't get into the 240 range or whatever they want him at as an NFL linebacker, he might be able to be like a strong safety. And I know that puts him in a bit of a tough spot as far as he's more of a coverage guy. But, I mean, 4.38 is fast no matter what position you play. And the fact he can do that, he's got at least enough athletic skill to find a position on the field if defenses are willing to be flexible and work with him and take a shot on him. So I hope he does well. I think it's a great story. I think that's awesome. So I don't know. That's a good question. Great question. I like that. Let's move on. I have one more for you. I've got another segment of real or fake. This is going to be just a fun one. Real or fake, English words edition. So you got to tell me if this is a real English word or if it's an Urban Dictionary word.
Okay, English like the United States?
Yeah, just like, yeah. Is it something that's actually in the Webster's Dictionary?
Okay.
So we're gonna start off with, and don't forget, I got a... And... God, this is so good. I love this. All right.
I gotta get me one of those.
What I can do is I can give you the word, and if you want the definition, I can give you the definition, and then you can guess.
Okay.
So first word is scriddle.
Definition?
Something between a scratch and a tickle.
That's fake.
Correct. That is an Urban Dictionary word, scriddle. Some of these are so funny. I can't wait to get to them. Okay, next word. Next word, canoodle.
Oh, that's real.
Yep, it means to caress or fondle. All right, next up, bumfuzzle.
Definition?
To confuse or bewilder. That is a real word. You appeared bumfuzzled by the fact that bumfuzzle is a real word.
Who says that?
I don't know, but we're going to start using it. cattywampus.
Oh, that's real.
Correct. That is a real word. It means askew or awry. What about a trilemma?
Fake.
Correct. Three things to consider instead of two. So instead of a dilemma, it's a trilemma. Oh, man. All right. Huggle.
Huggle.
Yeah.
Fake.
Correct. It's an Urban Dictionary word that means a combination of a hug and a cuddle.
It's like something I'd say to my 2-year-old.
All right, I got two more for you. Confrazzled.
I want to say fake, but I feel like there were too many fake ones. Fake.
Correct. That's Urban Dictionary as well. It means being confused and frazzled at the same time. all right, last one. Terradiddle.
Fake.
That's a real word. It means a petty lie or to a pretentious nonsense. So I told one little terradiddle with my top five when I put LeBron at number four.
I feel like just getting a laugh out of somebody if that word even comes out of your mouth. You're like, what did you just say?
So my goal is to try and use one of these in the next podcast when I'm interviewing Andrew Ross. I hope he listens to this one so he can remember those and be ready for it. all right, what's your second one?
Okay. My second one is, I heard this story on the radio the other day about a couple that their family was off, you know, doing the college thing, and they're empty nesters, and then they had their retirement all saved up. And so what they did was, because it was like their bucket list thing that they wanted to do, their pipe dream. They sold their house, sold their cars, they bought a sailboat.
Wow.
And they put everything on their sailboat, this beautiful sailboat, and they're going to sail the world, stop at different places, whatever it was. 20 miles out of California, they sank it.
What?
Lost everything, and they just sat there floating, waiting for the Coast Guard, while all their personal belongings either sank to the bottom of the Pacific or floated away. A rich multi-multi-millionaire heard about their story because they had blogged about it and gave them a sailboat.
Ooh.
So that they could continue on their journey, and then they all started a GoFundMe, and they raised almost $20,000 to get some new belongings back so they can start again. So my question is two parts. A, if you were in their position, would you go for attempt number two, knowing what just happened to you on attempt number one? And then B, what is your pipe dream or bucket list, you know, retirement, if you didn't have to worry about being close to your family or your kids or anything like that? It was just you and your wife, and you had no ties, and you could just do whatever you wanted to do.
That's a great question. Okay. Before I answer your question, when you were telling me the story, I was like trying to think where your question might go with all the facts you had given me, and my mind ran a couple different ways. One, boat sinking. I thought you were going to tell me that the lady didn't let her husband on and she died, kind of like a real he died like a real Titanic situation.
I should have just made it up and went that way.
Yeah. And then I don't remember what the second one was, but that's where I went first. Oh, and then when you were talking about a GoFundMe, I thought you were going to say, should we start a GoFundMe for the podcast? Which the answer to that is obviously yes, we should get that going as well. Okay.
Oh, man.
But my answer would be no to start for round number two. I wouldn't even consider going again. I feel like that would be so traumatizing the first time, like nearly sinking, right? Like, I don't know. I mean, I guess that there's more questions than answers. Like, was there a captain, or were they trying to sail it? Or like, what was the reason that it went down? Maybe if you get answers to that, like maybe it'll put my mind at ease. But like my initial answer to that is no, I would not do round number two. Second question of yours, what's my pipe dream? Oh man, that is a great question. I recently, since we started doing this podcast, I thought it would be great to go to every single Pac-12 football stadium for a home game, do like the whole tailgate and like document it and write it into a book and just kind of give information to people. And so trying to get to every one of those. But I think, I don't know. I feel like major sporting events would be in there. So like, I'd love to do the Super Bowl, World Series, NBA Finals. I Masters is one of my bucket list ones for sure. I think that would be pretty fun. Anything sports related that's major, I think that'd be where I would go.
Great choices. I haven't even really thought about it that much, but the sports events, Super Bowl, NBA Finals, World Series, things like that would be just great to do.
Yeah,
I've always been like a big RV guy. I've always wanted to. I never really wanted to own a boat. It just seems like too much work mm-hmm. and hassle. But I would love to own just a gigantic RV and just drive around, stop at different places, golf at different places. I mean, you could tour from Texas to Louisiana to Georgia to Florida to the Carolinas, up the coast, over the Midwest, and just every 4 hours, you know, stop somewhere, get a hotel, eat at the best restaurants, play around to golf, and then just keep doing that every day for like 2 months, and then come back and just see all the states. I've never really traveled anywhere internationally outside of like Puerto Rico and Mexico, the Bahamas. So I don't really know, and I'm not like a big world traveler, so I haven't really experienced that yet. But if I did that one time, I'd probably want to do something like that. But for me, golf would just have to be on the agenda. Like, I just want to play some of these amazing courses. I don't want to play, you know, Pebble and Muirfield and just all those incredible spots.
Yeah. If we win the lotto or somehow this podcast really takes off, we could combine our two pipe dreams. And we could RV to all of the Pac-12 football stadiums and play golf on the way. Two for one. Oh,
there
my
go.
Gosh.
Podcast on the road.
Oh, man. Well, this has been good. This was a fun one. This is a bit of a roller coaster. We had some fun. Then we got serious with the mental health stuff. And then we came back to some more fun. And that's how it should be. Just, you know, a little bit of all the emotions. What did Jimmy V say? If you don't laugh, cry. And what was the third one?
Laugh, cry.
And do something you love, I think. Something along those lines. Every single day. Or that's what you should do every single day. Laugh, cry, and do something you love. So, anywho, That wraps up this segment of the Blitz Package, as well as this episode of the Checkdown. We appreciate all the support. Please follow us on Twitter and Instagram at the Checkdown Podcast. Give us any feedback you may have, and we'll do the same damn thing next week. Kyle, thanks for coming on.
Always.
All right. Come on.